to citizenship for folks. But even with the laws that we have, making sure people have lawyers, they have some basic due process before they are facing deportation, means many more people access the asylum laws, other sort of forms of relief under current immigration law, which means it keeps people and families together. It keeps people in jobs. My organization, the Vera Institute of Justice, we run a national program where we're helping folks who are facing deportation have access to counsel. And literally, people are 10 times more likely to win their case and be able to stay in the country, stay with their families, be in their jobs and in their communities than if they have to go through deportation proceedings without a lawyer. And there's no right to a lawyer in those proceedings. And that's a really big problem for keeping families and communities together.
Well, just finally, what would you be looking for in a healthy public conversation about the changes we need to get from where we're at to where we could be? And maybe who would be in that conversation that isn't being heard from so much now?
Too often the conversation about immigration is dominated by politicians who are looking to score cheap political points. And if you listen to their rhetoric, they don't have a single solution. Mass deportation is not a solution. Building a wall is not a solution. And you know who actually has, and maybe there's unlikely players in this, but folks who actually have very clear solutions for how we have a real and thoughtful conversation about immigration, that's business owners and chambers of commerce. And again, I made the point earlier that economists are like, if we just shut down immigration, if we deport everybody, our economy will collapse. Nobody understands that better than businesses and business owners. And they're actually a really important voice in this conversation that often get overlooked. Just to go back to Springfield, Ohio, that we talked about, you actually saw the local Chamber of Commerce and a number of different business owners go out and speak publicly on the record, on the nighttime news and the newspaper and city council hearings to say, we need our immigrant workers and family members and community members because they are a vital part of our economy. So I actually think that's a missing voice in this conversation that could help to sort of bring the poles together, because the right likes business. I think the left can live with business if business is coming at, you know, the issues in the right way. And I think there's an opportunity to really actually bring people together and have a more reasoned, thoughtful conversation about what the path forward is.
Well, we've been speaking with Insha Rahman, Vice President of Advocacy and Partnerships at the Vera Institute of Justice and the Director of Vera Action. Find their work online at vera.org. Thank you so much, Insha Rahman, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me, Janine.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on our website, fair.org. That's also the place to show support for the show if you are able and so inclined. This show is engineered by Riley Baer. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all RDJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Techno Land? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh, right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Word to your mother.
Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and
one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The occupied territories are segregated. The jure is segregated. It's not, you know, hard to understand. There are different signs for where different people can go. There are different license plates forbidding different people from going different places. Now, what the authorities will tell you is that this is a security measure. But if you go back to the history of Jim Crow in this country, they would tell you the exact same thing.
As Israel's slaughter in Gaza enters its second year, and as Israel sends more troops into Lebanon, we speak to the prize-winning author and journalist, Ta-Nehisi Coates, about his new book, The Message, based in part on a trip he took last year to the occupied West Bank and Israel.
And we were driving out of East Jerusalem into the West Bank, and, you know, you could see the settlements, and they would point out the settlement. And it suddenly dawned on me that I was in a region of the world where some people could vote and some people could not. And that was obviously very, very familiar to me.
We'll talk to Ta-Nehisi Coates about his trip to Israel and Palestine, as well as traveling to Senegal, where he visited the slave trade memorial on Gori Island, and his trip to South Carolina, where school officials tried to ban his award-winning book, Between the World and Me. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Gaza, another 25 Palestinians have been killed as Israel's unrelenting war on the besieged Palestinian territory enters its second year. On Monday night, Israeli strikes in central Gaza hit houses in the Barij refugee camp in the city of Deir al-Balah, killing 5 children and 2 women.
The war is against civilians and children, women, the elderly. Who is this war against? What do we have in the Gaza Strip? Do we have aircraft carriers at sea or F-35 planes? What do we have? We have always been unarmed people. All Arab and European countries know that. We are oppressed and lost our rights.
With the latest killings, the official death toll from 1 year of Israel's war is approaching 42,000, according to Gaza's health ministry. That would mean Israeli attacks have killed 1 out of every 55 people living in Gaza, though the figure is likely significantly higher. More than 16,700 of the dead are children. In the occupied West Bank, the Palestinian Prisoners Society says Israeli forces detained another 30 Palestinians overnight during raids on Hebron, Nablus, Bethlehem, and occupied East Jerusalem. The group reports Israel's arrested more than 11,200 Palestinians across the West Bank in the past year. On Monday, 2 West Bank Palestinians were killed in separate Israeli raids. 12-year-old Hatem Gheith was fatally shot in the abdomen by Israeli forces in a raid on the Kalandia refugee camp. And in the city of Dura, Israeli troops fatally assaulted 66-year-old Ziad Abu Halil as they raided his home to arrest his brother. His widow, Basma, recounted the fatal assault.
We were asleep at 4 a.m. when the army surrounded the house and arrested my son. They took him out of the house. His father wanted to run after him, but they didn't let him. They pushed the door into him, and he fell and died. He became a martyr. We called the ambulance, and it didn't arrive.
Israel's expanded its attacks on southern Lebanon as it continues to strike Beirut's suburbs. The Israeli military said it's deployed more troops into southwest Lebanon, which followed intense overnight bombardment. In response, Hezbollah has launched a series of missile attacks into northern Israel, including the city of Haifa. Meanwhile, Israel's issued expulsion orders to about a quarter of the population on Lebanon's southern coastline ahead of a planned maritime attack. This all comes as the World Health Organization has expressed concern over intensifying Israeli attacks on healthcare workers and hospitals across Lebanon, which have so far forced the closure of at least 5 healthcare facilities. The WHO is also warning of disease outbreaks due to the overcrowded conditions in shelters for displaced people. In Dearborn, Michigan, thousands of mourners gathered at the Islamic Center of America Sunday to remember Haj Kamel Ahmed Jawad, a 56-year-old husband, father of 4, and Lebanese-American, killed by an Israeli airstrike on his hometown of Nabatieh, Lebanon, a week ago. Jawad's family says he'd chosen to remain near the city's main hospital to help the elderly, disabled, and those who couldn't afford to flee Israel's bombs. In a statement, his daughter, Nadine Jawad, wrote, "His life is one of over 50,000 lost at the hands of Israeli aggression across the Middle East. The fact that he was an American citizen should not make his story more important than others. As Muslims, we believe that every life matters. If my dad's story stands out to you, every other civilian murdered by the Israeli regime should as well," she said. A state of emergency has been declared in dozens of Florida counties, and evacuations are underway as residents brace for Hurricane Milton. The Category 4 storm is expected to make landfall Wednesday, bringing life-threatening storm surges, devastating winds, and torrential rain to Florida's Gulf Coast, including Tampa Bay, just 2 weeks after the region was battered by Hurricane Helene. Local crews are scrambling to haul most of the debris left behind by Helene's destruction ahead of Milton, which is expected to grow larger today as it grazes Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula. On Monday, veteran meteorologist John Morales of Miami broke down on live TV as Hurricane Milton temporarily strengthened into a Category 5 storm over the Gulf of Mexico.
It's just an incredible, incredible, incredible hurricane. It has dropped It has dropped 50 millibars in 10 hours. I apologize. This is just horrific. It is just gaining strength in the Gulf of Mexico, where you can imagine the winds, I mean, the seas are just so incredibly, incredibly hot, record hot, as you might imagine. You know what's driving that. I don't need to tell you. Global warming, climate change, leading to this and becoming an increasing threat.
Milton is one of the fastest intensifying storms ever recorded in the Atlantic. Its approach comes as the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, is facing severe staff shortages, with just about 9% of its workers, or about 1,200 people, available to respond to Hurricane Milton. Georgia's Supreme Court reinstated the state's 6-week abortion ban Monday, 1 week after a lower court struck down the ban, ruling it unconstitutional. Alice Wang from the Center for Reproductive Rights said, quote, "This ban has already killed multiple women, as the state's own Maternal Mortality Review Committee found last month." Yet Attorney General Carr rushed to court to reinstate this ban, ensuring more lives will be lost, unquote. In another blow to abortion rights, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled Monday Texas doctors cannot be compelled to perform emergency abortions if the procedure is deemed to violate Texas's abortion ban. The far-right-led Supreme Court, which overturned Roe v. Wade in 2022, rejected the Biden administration's invocation of the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act, EMTALA, which requires health providers to intervene if a patient's life is at risk. In Colorado, former Mesa County Clerk Tina Peters was sentenced to 9 years in prison for crimes she committed in the wake of the 2020 election as she peddled false claims about rigged voting machines following Donald Trump's loss. District Judge Matthew Barrett castigated Peters as he handed down her sentence last Thursday.
You are no hero. You abused your position, and you're a charlatan who used and is still using your prior position in office to peddle a snake oil that's been proven to be junk time and time again.
Since last week's sentencing, Judge Barrett and court staff report they've received threats. Tina Peters is the first election official to be convicted of criminal charges for attempting to overturn the 2020 election based on right-wing conspiracy theories. In labor news, some 600 workers at two Hilton hotels in Boston have gone on strike, joining thousands of others in at least four other U.S. cities who've walked off the job demanding higher wages, better staffing, and fair workloads. Those striking include housekeepers, front desk agents, cooks, dishwashers, servers, bartenders, bellhops, and door attendants. A total of more than 4,700 hotel workers with the Unite Here union are currently on strike at Hilton, Hyatt, and Marriott hotels in Boston, Honolulu, San Diego, and San Francisco. In Tunisia, incumbent President Kais Saied won Sunday's election with some 90% of the vote. The turnout was less than 29%, as Saied's critics called for a boycott of the election, which came after the president orchestrated a widespread crackdown on dissent, jailing political rivals, journalists, lawyers, and activists. Since coming to power 3 years ago, Saied dissolved parliament, dismantled Tunisia's judiciary, and rewrote the constitution, what's been described as a coup. Ahead of the vote last Friday, protesters rallied in Tunis. This is the renowned filmmaker Ibrahim Latif.
Today we had to go out despite the unfortunate fact that the election results are almost predetermined. However, this anger must continue until we stop the bleeding that affects rights and freedoms.
And here in New York, Jewish activists and allies gathered Monday for a vigil on the first anniversary of October 7th. To mourn Israelis and Palestinians who've been killed and call for an end to the Israeli massacre in Gaza and beyond. Participants performed prayers, read out the names of those whose lives have been lost. Democracy Now! Spoke to Eva Borgwardt of the group If Not Now! At the vigil.
So the motto is Every Life, a Universe, and it's from Pikuach Nefesh, which says that to destroy a life is to destroy an entire world, and to save a life is to save an entire world. And our government is not treating every single life as a universe. They're treating Palestinian lives as less sacred.
That was Eva Borgwardt, national spokesperson of the group If Not Now!. Another speaker who joined a later rally of Israeli Americans who are relatives of hostages in Gaza also spoke.
My name is Adi, and I'm an Israeli American. A year ago, I was here in New York with my mother, anxiously texting our family in Be'eri as they were trapped in their homes, listening to the sounds of a massacre outside. Abandoned by the Israeli government to fend for themselves. My uncle was murdered, together with 100 other kibbutz members, and 31 members were kidnapped to Gaza. The brutality did not start a year ago, but for me and most of the people I know from my region in the world, this year was like a magnifying glass to the unimaginable damage of oppression, occupation, war, and violence. Now take this loss as I feel today and multiply it by millions and millions. The millions of Palestinians, Lebanese, Israelis, Iranians, millions of hundreds who lost lives, lost one, loved ones, body functions, their homes, food, shelter, things with sentimental values, a million little connections lost forever. I want to scream. Scream. None of them are my enemy. I want nothing but peace and healing for all of them.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, prize-winning author and journalist Ta-Nehisi Coates on his new book, The Message. He traveled to the occupied West Bank in Israel, to South Carolina, and to Senegal. Ta-Nehisi Coates for the hour. Stay with us.
Many suggestions and documents written. Many directions for the aid that was given. They gave us pieces of silver and pieces of gold. Tell me who paid reparations on my soul. Many fine speeches.
Pay Reparations on My Soul by Gil Scott-Heron. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I am Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Vigils and memorials were held across the globe Monday and this weekend on the first anniversary of October 7th, to mourn Israelis and Palestinians who've been killed over the past year. The anniversary comes as Israel's widening its assault on Gaza and sending more troops into Lebanon. Today we spend the hour with the acclaimed writer, the journalist Ta-Nehisi Coates, author of the new book, The Message, based in part on a trip he took last year to the occupied West Bank in Israel. Ta-Nehisi compares Israel's apartheid system to that of Jim Crow here in the United States. He writes, "It occurred to me that there was still one place on the planet under American patronage that resembled the world that my parents were born into." In his book, Ta-Nehisi Coates also writes about traveling to Senegal, where he visited the slave trade memorial at Gori Island, and going to South Carolina, where school officials tried to ban his book, Between the World and Me, which won the National Book Award in 2015. The message is written as a letter to his students at Howard University, where Ta-Nehisi Coates is the Sterling Brown Endowed Chair in the English Department. The Message is Ta-Nehisi's first collection of nonfiction work since his 2017 book, We Were 8 Years in Power, an American Tragedy. Ta-Nehisi, welcome back to Democracy Now! Last time during the pandemic, you were in another studio, so it's great to be with you in our New York studio. I wanted to read one of your quotes. "We're plagued by dead language and dead stories that serve people whose aim is nothing short of a dead world. It's not enough to stand against these dissemblers. There has to be something in you, something that hungers for clarity. You'll need that hunger, because if you follow that path soon enough, you'll find yourself confronting not just their myths, not just their stories, but your own." Ta-Nehisi Coates in The Message. We're going to talk a lot about what's happening in the occupied territories, in Gaza, in the West Bank. But I wanted to start where you go in The Message first, and that is to Senegal.
Right.
Talk about this journey that you actually took with great trepidation.
I did. As you said, you know, we'll spend a lot of time talking about the occupied territories in Israel and the West Bank. But it's good to start here, because the two parts are kind of paired to each other. African Americans are a group of people who have lived under the weight of artifice a creation, a kind of mythology of what Africa is in our minds. If all of the myths of racism, all the justifications for enslavement, all the justifications for Jim Crow, at the end of the day, they have their origins in these constructions of Africa as this savage place, the idea that, you know, having been brought here, we're better off. Very, very typical of, you know, colonizing and conquering movements. And one of the things we've done to push back is create our own narratives, our own journeys, our own ideas of what Africa is. My very name comes out of that, which I'm very uncomfortable with, as I talk about in the book. And
talk about it.
Oh, boy. Oh, Lord. I wrote it. I should be very comfortable talking about it. You know, I was born in 1975, and that was a period in time coming out of Black Power, coming out of, you know, Black is Beautiful, like really discovering this idea that our sense of beauty, our nose, our lips, our names, our hair, that we had the right to take control over that, including our history. And so my name is an ancient Egyptian name that refers to the ancient kingdom of Nubia. The notion was that, put very, very crudely, that if the West had its kings and queens, if it had its great monuments, if it had its great ideas, so did we. And part of growing older, part of, you know, and I actually talk about this in Between the World and Me, part of becoming a writer, actually, is like our job is to be skeptical of clean stories. And I learned that very, very early on. And the message is kind of a continuation of that. Of course, the ultimate, I would say, I guess, climax in that journey is going to see the continent itself and moving past myth, moving past the idea of constructed narratives, even when they're liberatory, even when they're emancipationist, to see the people themselves. And that is what took me to Dakar. And that is what I think took so long for me to go to Dakar.
And in terms of what most surprised you in the trip, could you talk about that?
Yeah, which most surprised me is the thing that will not surprise any African-American watching this interview. It was my deep sorrow. Is my deep, deep, deep sorrow. And I think, like, much of what I've, you know, just said in answer to Amy's question, I'd already intellectualized before I went. And so I was already thinking about this, but thinking about something and being confronted with it is a totally, totally different thing. It's a great Mike Tyson said, everybody's got a plan until they got punched. And as soon as that plane started descending out of the clouds over Dakar and I saw the buildings rising up, I was being punched. It is one thing to think about the Middle Passage, to think about your ancestors theoretically. It is quite another to literally sit on the edge of the Atlantic Ocean and look out and understand that this was, even if only symbolically, last stop.
And when you went to Gore, you decided that you did not want to have any of the tour guides.
No.
You wanted to wander around on your own.
No, but
talk about that experience.
By then it was like day three. And so I understood that as much as I thought I was going to see the continent, I was actually going to see some sort of departed version of myself, you know, from hundreds of years ago. I was walking with ghosts the whole time, and I didn't want to be talked to. My family is from the eastern shore of Maryland, not too far from Ocean City, for anybody who knows that geography. It's like right on the Atlantic Ocean. And so to get back to Senegal, to get to Dakar, which is itself right on the tip of the continent, you know, I would look out and I would have these moments and I would say, my God, you know what I mean? There's part of me all the way on the other side and there's part of me that's here. And so, again, Gore is a place that has a lot of story and a lot of myth around it. And I read about that. I thought I was fully prepared. But I'm going to tell you, brother, you get on that boat and that boat pulls off and you think about all of your ancestors. And it was 7 a.m. in the morning and I was alone on that boat. And it is a very, very different experience.
And back to your name, Ta-Nehisi.
Yes.
And also, which goes to your parents as well.
Yes.
And how their influence on you. Your dad, a former Black Panther, ran a publishing publishing press right in your house.
Yeah. No, and I think, like, what they were really trying to do, and this actually goes to the core of what the book is about. How do you tell your own story? How do you free yourself from a history, from novels, from film, from television, an entire architecture that is designed to tell you that you are exactly where you belong, because of who you are, because of what you are, either because of your genes, because God said, you know, you belong there. How do you construct something different? And one of the things I'm trying to confront in the book is, I think perhaps step one is almost to make a mirror image of the people that have put you in that situation. Well, you say with this, we're actually that. But I think one of the most difficult things is to free yourself entirely of that structure and to construct your own morality, your own stories, your own ideas that don't necessarily depend on those who have put you in the situation to begin with.
And the structure of your book is addressed to your students at Howard. The decision to choose that form for your book?
You know, I was, to be honest with you, I've not said this anywhere. I was very worried about that because I'd done that. Like, I'd written this letter in Between the World and Me, and I thought people could get, oh, my God, he's going to do this again, what, Between the World and Me again. But the fact of the matter is I am always trying to achieve intimacy with the reader. That's the, you know, the primary job. I would tell my students all the time, look, you are dealing with readers who could be doing anything else. They could be on their smartphones. They could be playing video games. They could be watching movies. They could be watching TV. They could be somewhere making love. They could be doing anything but reading you. And so you have a responsibility to make them feel a sense of intimacy and immediacy. And I was lucky in the sense that, you know, these were very, very real conversations that I'd had with my students, so I had something to pull from, you know. And also, you know, the fact of just the letter form allowed me to do that. It allows me to get, you know, a kind of intimacy with my reader.
Talk about George Orwell, Why I Write, and connecting politics and language in the promise you made to your students at Howard. Your Between the World and Me was written to your son, Samari, this to the students.
Yeah. So we usually start actually with politics in the English language. That's the first essay that I have them read, you know, just to think about language as a political thing. You know, we live in this world where I feel that oftentimes we are taught, not that everybody subscribes to this, that art lives over here and politics lives over here. And that politics itself is actually very, very limited, that, you know, it happens every 2 or 4 years. It's in the voting booth. It's who you decide, you know, to vote for. It's what issues you decide to activate on. But one of the arguments that I make in the message is that there's an entire architecture outside of the world of mean politics that determines how politicians actually talk, the choices they give, you know, et cetera. Why does Kamala Harris feel the need, for instance, to say that she has a gun? What is that actually based on? And I would say it is based on archetypes of femininity. I would say it's built based on archetypes of race, archetypes of the cowboy. And where do those archetypes come from? They come from our art. They come from our literature. They come from our film, our TVs, our commercials. You know, and at their base, they ultimately come from writing because somebody has to write those ultimately. And in that world, things that seem separated from politics never really are. And so I wanted to start this book, The Message, with that Orwell quote, because that's like one of the things he kind of is obsessing with in that essay. And at the same time, there's this beautiful tension that I often feel, which is in a different world, you know, he would just write beautiful stories. He would just play with language for the hell of playing with language. But he doesn't live in that world. And I don't feel that my students live in that world. They live in a world of as we'll talk about, genocide, apartheid, segregation, global warming, you know, Category 5 hurricanes, you know, flood on one coast, fire on the other. These are immediate issues. And I don't believe that they as writers, we as writers, have the luxury of sort of sitting back in our salons and in our living rooms, you know, simply constructing beautiful language for the hell of constructing beautiful language. It has to be engaged with something.
From Senegal, you take us to Columbia, South Carolina. Mm-hmm. Why that choice?
Well, I was writing this in a time where this wave of book bannings was happening. And I always wanted to write about that. But I felt that I was worried about making the writer the center of the book banning. Because even though the work is directed at the writer, the writer is actually not the person that suffers under the book ban. The teachers suffer under the book ban. It's the teachers who are under threat for losing their job. It's the teachers who get harassed. It's the librarians who are under threat of losing their jobs. It's the librarians who get harassed. It's the students who lose the ability to have access to different worlds and different ways of thinking. And I was trying to figure out how I could write this in such a way so that I would not be the center of it. Luckily, you know, I ended up in conversation with a teacher by the name of Mary Wood from Chapin, South Carolina, went to Chapin High School where she teaches and where she was trying to teach Between the World and Me and got into some amount of trouble for that. And she invited me down, you know, just to, you know, go to a hearing. And that's what I did. And it was quite eventful. It was not the world that I expected. It was not the the audience I expected. It was interesting to see how much support actually was rallied behind her, even though she's in a deep red area, in a deep red state. And so that, too, is about the power of stories. That, too, is about the power of narratives, the questions we ask and the questions we don't.
You write in the message about this experience in mm-hmm. South Carolina. I see politicians in Colorado and Tennessee and South Carolina moving against my own work, tossing books I've authored out of libraries, banning them from classes. I feel snatched out of the present and dropped into an age of pitchforks and book-burning bonfires. My first instinct is to laugh, but then I remember that American history is filled with men and women who were as lethal as they were ridiculous.
Right.
Now, if
you got one running for president right now, you know, lethal and ridiculous.
Well, you talk about the area you were in, 70-30 split, 70% for mm-hmm. Trump. And yet, and this is what you were just talking about, this 30%, yeah. how surprised you were by the minority, the power of it when it's mobilized.
Yeah, you know, it's like one of these things, like, again, like this goes back to how we construct language. It's either a blue or red district, right? Even purple doesn't quite, like, carry the quite, you know, like, the real context. So you think it's red, okay, battle's over, why am I here? You know? But 30% and 30% activated around an actual issue is actually a lot of people. You know what I mean? And it was like, I could not have known that without seeing it. Like, you have to, and this is, like, one of the messages I have, you know, for my students in the book. You have to walk the land. You can't, you know, sit on your butt reading reports, you know what I mean, and even reading books like this one and say, hey, I'm going to be a writer. You have to have actual experiences. So I have to walk in that room, you know, and meet this, you know, white woman in her 70s, you know, who tells me in the wake of George Floyd, we organized a reading group at our church for black authors. And I love Colson Whitehead. Oh, my God. Have you read him? You know, like I have to have that experience with somebody. You know, I have to have that shock, you know. And so I just feel like it was, like, really, really important in the message to actually model the work that I was articulating, or model the lessons that I was actually articulating for my students.
When you just referred to President Trump, can you elaborate further?
He looks ridiculous, but he is, in fact, quite lethal, you know? And I think certainly in 2016, there was great, great temptation to laugh. You know what I mean? You hear these things, you know, you hear him say certain things, you know, you see him, you know, in certain places, and there's a kind of dismissiveness. But what we actually are dismissing is a kind of darkness that I think lurks deep, deep within all of us and can actually be appealed to. It's not comfortable to say that you can win through hate. It's not comfortable to say that you can win through anger. It's not comfortable to say historically it actually has been very effective at, you know, electorally, to pick out weak people or people who are not in, you know, the most advantaged political space and to demonize them and use them as a tool, that actually has been quite effective for people in pursuit of power. We would rather think that good wins all the time, that people see the best in each other. It reifies our notions of what America is, our stories that we tell ourselves of what America is, but it doesn't correspond with the actual history and the truth.
Ta-Nehisi, we're going to break, and then when we come back to your new book, The Message, we're going to talk about Israel and Palestine. This is Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
That I was searching for a love I've never known, though I've looked tell the world that I
stop my crying. When you touch me with your smile.
Tell the World by The Platters. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Last night, here in New York, hundreds of activists, Jewish and Jewish allies and Palestinians, rallied in Union Square for a vigil on the first anniversary of October 7th to mourn Israelis and Palestinians who've been killed and to call for an end to the Israeli massacre in Gaza and beyond. People performed prayers. There were rabbis there. And they read out the names of those who've lost their lives. One of those who spoke, I talked to afterwards, Eva Bergwart. She is a spokesperson for the group, If Not Now.
Right now, people are wearing signs that say, no U.S. money for bombs. And talk about the motto of this October 7th vigil.
So the motto is every life a universe, and it's from Pikuach Nefesh, which says that to destroy a life is to destroy an entire world, and to save a life is to save an entire world. And our government is not treating every single life as a universe. They're treating Palestinian lives as less sacred.
How did you get so involved with this issue?
I got involved through the Ferguson uprising, and I was watching Black and Palestinian activists trading tips on Twitter about how to deal with tear gas, and it became clear that Palestinians in the West Bank are facing a military charged with policing, and Black Americans are facing a militarized police force. And that was my entry point, where I said I need to organize my community, which was unable to, which was limited in being able to show up for the civil rights fight of our time, for the Black Lives Matter movement, because they were upset about the messaging for a free Palestine in those protests. And so I've spent the last 10 years of my life working on building the movement of Jewish Americans who are calling for equality, justice, and a thriving future for all, no matter where people live.
That's Eva Bergwart of the group If Not Now, one of hundreds of people here in New York City and Union Square for two large rallies on the anniversary of October 7th. Our guest today is Ta-Nehisi Coates, the prize-winning journalist and author of the new book, The Message, in part about a visit he took last year, organized by the Palestine Festival of Literature, PALFEST, to the West Bank and Israel. Talk about this whole journey you took. You were part of the PALFEST, and then you also stayed.
Yeah, and I guess, to be honest, my journey began 10 years ago when I published the case for reparations. And there was a section, again, as a writer, as a journalist, you're always trying to make people feel things, make things real. And there was a section where I offered an analog for reparations, for how it could possibly look. And it was from West Germany to the state of Israel. And I need to be very specific about that, not to Holocaust survivors, but to the state of Israel itself. And that part of that essay came under quite a bit of critique. And what became clear to me was deservedly so. It took 10 years for me to get it fixed because writing takes a long time, you know? But I knew I had to, like, that I was going to have to go at some point. You know, I knew it wouldn't be enough for me to, you know, appear at a rally, do a slogan, whatever. And long story short, I began talking to PALFEST in 2016, finally got there in 2023, just in time for the message. I spent 5 days with them. Mostly traveling through the occupied territories and through East Jerusalem as a Palestinian would, getting a sense of what their daily life was. And then the next 5 days, I spent mostly in the company of a group called Breaking the Silence, former IDF veterans who are against the occupation. And I saw the country largely through the views of an Israeli, how they move through the world, how they move through Jerusalem, how they move through the roads. But I also, again, you know, spent a lot of time actually talking, you know, more to Palestinians. It was revelatory. It was, I don't think the average American has a real sense of what we're doing over there. And I emphasize what we're doing, because it's not possible without American support. I have heard people say over and over again that there are great evils happening in the world, states across the world perpetrating evils against whole groups of people. Why pick on Israel? And the thing I say is, I'm an American. This is the thing that we have our fingerprints on. Those bombs over Gaza, the planes that drop bombs on Gaza, the plaques that I saw, for instance, in Jerusalem, all of that is America. And we are going around the world propping ourselves up as the font of democracy. We are going around the world propping Israel up as the only democracy in Middle East. This is a deep, deep fiction, a very, very dangerous fiction that must be addressed. And that's what I tried to do in the book.
You write in the book, quote, "It occurred to me that there was still one place on the planet under American patronage that resembled the world that my parents were born into." Can you elaborate?
Yes, and I think I talked about it the last time I was here, actually. These are the words I have even now, and they are probably insufficient to what a Palestinian would offer who experiences this. But the words that come to me are segregation. When you are on the West Bank, there are separate roads. There are roads for Israeli settlers and citizens of Israel, and there are roads for Palestinians. These roads are not separate and equal. These roads tend to be separate and unequal. It tends to take longer to get where you want to go if you're Palestinian. If you enter a city like Hebron, for instance, Hebron is quite literally segregated. There are streets that Palestinians cannot walk down. There are streets that, you know, Israeli settlers are given complete and free movement of. Moving throughout the West Bank in general, there are checkpoints everywhere for Palestinians. These checkpoints are sometimes normal checkpoints that they know are there. Sometimes checkpoints appear out of the blue, what they call flying checkpoints. Your basic movement is constantly imperiled. The justice system, which is deeply familiar for African Americans here, is quite literally segregated. There is a civil justice system that the minority of Israeli settlers as Israeli citizens enjoy. And then there is an entirely separate justice system that Palestinians on the West Bank are subject to. You can be arrested, for instance, as an Israeli citizen, and you are, you know, do all the due rights that we are familiar with. You have to be told what the charges are, et cetera. If you are arrested as a Palestinian, you can just be taken. In another political context, we would call those hostages, because nobody has to say why you're taken. Nobody has to say what you were taken for. Nobody has to inform your family. You are under the jurisdiction of the military. It has been this way since 1967. And the word we use for that is occupation, which is a kind of deeply vanilla word that does not actually describe what is going on. How a country that maintains this separate and unequal system, how a country that does not even allow the quote-unquote Palestinian citizens of the state full equality with its Jewish-Israeli citizens is allowed to refer to itself as a democracy is a mystery to me, and the closest analog I can think of is the time in which the United States of America referred to itself as a democracy, even as it was disenfranchising whole swaths of black people in the southern states. And so when I say Jim Crow, when I say segregation, that is because that is the period that immediately comes to mind for me.
Talk about being stopped by an Israeli soldier, Ta-Nehisi.
Oh, well, we were stopped all the time, to be clear, you know, because we were on the roads. We were constantly stopped. You know, I was, you know, you just kind of got used to it after a while, which was also weirdly familiar. But I think the instance you're referring to is when I was in Hebron, which is a flashpoint for anybody that's been over there. I was walking down the street attempting to patronize a Palestinian vendor, and a guard, IDF guard or IDF soldier stopped out. He was young enough to be my son, stopped out and asked me what was my religion. It was clear that I had to state my religion in order to pass. When I told him that I was not religious, he asked what my mother's religion was. When I told him my mother wasn't particularly religious, he asked what my grandmother's religion was. And this is a very, very important thing, because when you start asking what my mother and grandmother's religion is, you are referring to something beyond, do I accept Christ as my, you know, personal savior, or what God I pray to. You are asking a deeper question about my ancestry. And it became clear that if I did not give the right answer to that question, I would not be allowed to pass. I highlight this because when you hear Palestinian and Palestinian-American activists make the charge of racism, this is what they're talking about. Why does who my grandmother or my mother worship matter if we're strictly talking about a God? Not that it would be right even in that sense. But when you hear the charge of racism, this is what people are referring to.
Ta-Nehisi, this is a powerful book, and you went on CBS This Morning recently to talk about the publication of it. And I want to go to that interview on CBS This Morning. The New York Times is now reporting CBS News has rebuked one of the morning anchors, Tony DeCoppel, over what he did in that interview to you. And maybe you could also say to his fellow anchors as he dominated this. CBS executives said the interview fell short of the network's editorial standards. This is an excerpt of that interview.
Ta-Nehisi, I want to dive into the Israel-Palestine section of the book. It's the largest section of the book. And I have to say, when I read the book, I imagine if I took your name out of it, took away the awards and the acclaim, took the cover off the book, the publishing house goes away, the content of that section would not be out of place in the backpack of an extremist. And so then I found myself wondering, why does Ta-Nehisi Coates, who I've known for a long time, read his work for a long time, very talented, smart guy, leave out so much? Why leave out that Israel is surrounded by countries that want to eliminate it? Why leave out that Israel deals with terror groups that want to eliminate it? Why not detail anything of the first and the second intifada, the cafe bombings, the bus bombings, the little kids blown to bits? And is it because you just don't believe that Israel, in any condition, has a right to exist?
Well, I would say the perspective that you just outlined, there is no shortage of that perspective in American media. That's the first thing I would say. I am most concerned always with those who don't have a voice, with those who don't have the ability to talk. I have asked repeatedly in my interviews whether there is a single network, mainstream organization in America with a Palestinian-American bureau chief or correspondent who actually has a voice to articulate their part of the world. I've been a reporter for 20 years. The reporters of those who believe more sympathetically about Israel and its right to exist don't have a problem getting their voice out. But what I saw in Palestine, what I saw on the West Bank, what I saw in Haifa in Israel, what I saw in the South Hebron Hills, those were the stories that I have not heard.
So, Ta-Nehisi, you sitting on the set of CBS This Morning with the former football player, now anchor, Nate Burleson, Gail King, very well known, both African-American anchors, and Tony DeCoppo. He dominated the discussion, talking about your book could be found in an extremist backpack. Talk about the backlash on this, the aftermath of this, and also who you felt was most wronged in this.
Well, it wasn't me. I mean, at that part, let me talk. It was not me, you know. It certainly—and I don't know if there was anybody on that set. Look, I think there is a meta conversation that happens here where we end up—because we're media, where we end up talking about media and media politics. But I do think it's really important to broaden the frame from the few people that were there and talk about what was actually excluded and who was actually excluded from that conversation by the very structure itself. I just don't want to lose sight of that. I don't really have a problem with a tough interview. You know, I knew what I wrote. You know, I knew I'd be confronted. Was he rude? Was he aggressive? I can't really get into that. Like, it's not really something that I think too much about. The question I would ask, though, is how often on CBS, on NBC, on ABC, or any major news organization, do you see someone who is a defender of the Israeli state project get confronted in that kind of way, given a tough interview in that kind of way? When was the last time you saw, for instance, a defender of Israel, a defender of Zionism, confronted with the fact that major human rights organizations say that Israel is practicing apartheid? How do you defend that? When is the last time you've seen an interviewer? How often do you see interviewers? Because I don't want to say it never happens. How often do you see interviewers say, listen, we have, you know, the former head of Human Rights Watch that says you are practicing genocide right now in Gaza. How do you respond to that? How often do you see, how do you define yourself as a democracy when fully half the people under your rule are not equal? There is no problem with confronting me. You know, I would like to see some other people confronted. And the second part of that is who gets to do the confronting in the first place. I have said, and I will continue to say, I am a a little uncomfortable with this role and a little uncomfortable with the publicity, not because I feel like I do not know, but because I feel like there are people who are going through this experience and who have gone through this experience who know so much more, who are completely out of the frame. And those are Palestinians and Palestinian Americans. So it's not just the issues that I raise in the confrontation. The question I would ask is, you have to imagine a world where a Palestinian American journalist could be on a mainstream show like CBS This Morning and confront someone who wrote a book that, say, defended Israel or defended Zionism with that kind of aggression. It's fine if I get it, but I want to live in that world, too. You know, and that really is, you know, like one of the things I was really, really trying to get at in the book, in the message. You know, it's the questions we ask. It's the stories we get to tell and the stories that we don't tell. And perhaps most importantly, it's who gets to tell them and who doesn't. And I really feel this passionately. This is not about me. This is not about Tony. This is not about Gail. This is not about Nick. We're going to be fine. It's the people who are invisible. It's the people who were not in that set, you know, on that set to begin with, who are not part of that conversation.
And Ta-Nehisi, this criticism that you are sufficiently taking into account the history, when the reality is, here we are on the anniversary of the October 7th attacks, and very little discussion occurs about what was Gaza like before October 7th of last year, and how were the residents of Gaza being treated, and essentially in an open air prison.
Yes, no, I completely agree. Look, I love that the young lady who was saying earlier in the lead in, every life is a unit. I truly believe that. And so, you know, as I've said before, like, there really is no part of my politics that has the ability to look at October 7th and not mourn the death, the massacre, the atrocities, you know, perpetrated. I just wish that some of my countrymen, especially my countrymen, especially Americans who are responsible for this, who are propping this up, had that same sort of compassion and that same sort of energy for October 6th, October 5th, et cetera. You know, this kind of abstracting events outside, you know, of their historical context is really necessary to the political order, because it allows us to justify ourselves and not have to think harder and not have to ask, you know, much deeper questions. You really have to be able to hold both, you know, and I know that sounds a bit cliche, but I truly do believe that you have to, you know, believe in this idea that I actually just heard today, that every life is a universe. I think that's a really, really beautiful articulation, you know, and that has to be true for all life. That has to be true on October 7th, you know, and loudly said, but it has to be true on 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 also.
And also, I wanted to go back for a second, because we are running out of time, and ask you about—
I'm sorry, my answers are so long.
about President Trump and the coming upcoming election. The great surprise to me all these years now is the enormous support that Donald Trump still has among huge swaths of the American public. To what do you attribute this?
Darkness. There's a darkness in all of us. I mean, this is not new, you know? I mean, and if you just took American history from the perspective of an African American, and I suspect the from the perspective of the indigenous people of this continent, what they would tell you is there is nothing new in people using power and people using the worst tropes in the world to win and to dominate. For any black person that, you know, grew up in the South from, I don't know, 1876 to 1964 and probably beyond, I'm being very conservative by saying that, this is what politics was. Like, this is just what we, you know, grew up under. And so I think maybe we thought, or we allowed ourselves to believe, that somehow, you know, we had escaped the gravity of history. But no people. No country escapes the gravity of history. We live within it. We are part of it. And so, you know, I think it's a very, very dangerous thing that our leaders led us to believe in 2016 that this was like a thing that could not happen in America. You know, whereas had we looked at history from another perspective, we would know that this actually is very American. You know, that doesn't make us, you know, inhuman or somehow demonically evil. And, you know, on the contrary, it just makes us human. It means that we're subject to, you know, the darkness in our souls like any other group of people would be.
Ta-Nehisi, I wanted to go to that point you say of who gets heard. We were at the Democratic convention. Mm. Everywhere we were interviewing people, we saw you in the background.
Yes,
we were interviewing the delegate from, Michigan, from Florida, and from Connecticut, who unfurled a banner in the Florida delegation that said, stop arming Israel.
Yeah.
You were there as we were interviewing them in the hallway. When we were outside, when they were about to begin the sleep-in overnight, demand that Kamala Harris allow a Palestinian-American to speak, you were there. And then the next day, and you wrote a piece in Vanity Fair about your experience, a Palestinian-American's place under the Democrats' big tent, the piece looking at the uncommitted movement and their unsuccessful efforts to have such a speaker. This is Rura Roman of the uncommitted movement. She's a Palestinian-American Georgia state representative. This is part of what she would have said if she was chosen.
For 320 days, we've stood together demanding to enforce our laws on friend and foe alike to reach a ceasefire and the killing of Palestinians, free all the Israeli and Palestinian hostages, and to begin the difficult work of building a path to collective peace and safety. That's why we are here. Members of this Democratic Party committed to equal rights and dignity for all. What we do here echoes around the world. They'll say this is how it's always been, that nothing can change. But remember, Fannie Lou Hamer shunned for her courage, yet she paved the way for an integrated Democratic Party. Her legacy lives on, and it's her example we follow.
So that's Georgia State Representative Rua Roman. And needless to say, there was not a Palestinian-American voice on the stage. Last night, Kamala Harris did an interview with 60 Minutes. At least they played it last night. This is what she had to say about Israel-Palestine.
When we think about the threat that Hamas, Hezbollah presents, Iran, I think that it is, without any question, our imperative to do what we can to allow Israel to defend itself against those kinds of attacks. Now, the work that we do diplomatically with the leadership of Israel is an ongoing pursuit around making clear our principles, which include the need for humanitarian aid, the need for this war to end, the need for a deal to be done which would release the hostages and create a ceasefire. And we're not going to stop in terms of putting that pressure on Israel and in the region, including Arab leaders.
That's Democratic presidential nominee Kamala Harris speaking on 60 Minutes last night. As we wrap up, you were just talking about Trump. Talk about what the position of the Biden-Harris administration is right now. They did hold two separate commemorations yesterday. President Biden was at the White House, and he lit a candle and also, I think, crossed himself right after. And Kamala Harris, the vice president in the Naval Observatory, planted a tree, a pomegranate tree.
Well, and, you know, that's good and appropriate, you know. Like I said, you know, we don't want to have a politic that does not take life serious and does not take loss of life serious. On the larger question, and maybe even as an extension of that, but we have to take all life seriously. I don't think we're doing that. This is morally untenable. What I saw was, and this is the first time I've ever said this or put this in this frame, and maybe, you know, the uncommitted delegates understood this. There was as much a moral gap between what I saw in Chicago, that is to say, to go on stage and promote these values of diversity, humanity, big tent, and to exclude the people whose families are being bombed right now, as it was in the early 1960s and, you know, before, when the Democratic Party, you know, claimed to be for the working man and the working person, while millions of workers all through the South were effectively in a system of indentured servitude, and they refused to give those people political representation. It is a gigantic moral gulf that is troubling, disappointing, heartbreaking, and deeply, deeply personally upsetting.
Ta-Nehisi Coates, award-winning journalist, author, professor. His new book is The Message. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman in New York with Juan Gonzalez in Chicago.
Members or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hi, I'm Richard Gordon, and welcome to Forbes Avenue here on WRCT Pittsburgh. On May 7th of 2024, I had the privilege of interviewing bassist Ron Carter, right around the time he turned 87 years old. And before I share the conversation we had, let's play a number from his catalog. This is from a 2006 record where he collaborated with guitarist Bill Frisell and drummer Paul Motion. And it's a trio version of a song that Ron Carter wrote with Miles Davis called 81.